Here is That Which Is with John Morton. That Which Is presented by MSIA, the Movement of Spiritual Inner Awareness, a movement dedicated to awakening the spiritual heart within each of us. John Morton is the spiritual director of MSIA. He has given seminars and workshops worldwide for MSIA, for the Institute for Individual and World Peace, and for other organizations dedicated to improving people's lives. This program is entitled, What is Perfect Alignment? Right after John Morton speaks, we'll tell you how you can obtain more information about John Morton and MSIA.
So I'm going to see if I can do my own bit to be John Roger today. Thank you, I appreciate that. Yeah, but I know when you, like I do, have a relationship not only to somebody who you feel very close to as a friend, a benefactor. I look at John Roger as a benefactor in my life because he's just brought so much good. And you know that there's a part of that word benefactor that means good. And so he's a benefactor in my life in so many ways. When I've been sharing recently at these book events about loving each day for moms and dads, I had a chance to talk to John Roger as a dad in my family. And he's much bigger than that, but he's very active as a parent in the most wonderful way. So I'm privileged in that. And what I realized too is that we're all being raised as children, that if we were ever a child, we're still a child now, and that he's somebody that is raising me, and I certainly look at him as raising us in this movement of spiritual inner awareness. And I've had a lot of emotions show up today, on the way to being up here, watching the videos, listening to how the movement takes its turns through a dark forest somewhere, and we still come out to really good things. And I was hearkening back a bit to 1978 at a conference in Los Angeles that we did, which was the Insight Conference. Anybody here was also there at that conference? So look at that. See, we have some continuity going here in this movement of spiritual inner awareness. There were a few of us in this room that were in that room as well. And that was when I did my first Insight 1 seminar as a participant, which is one of the greatest seminars around, which John Roger founded. And he was involved in my very first Insight seminar. And at the end, at the conference, he spoke to the gathering there. And I think there were a number, well, there definitely were a number of seminars that were going on. And I think there was an advanced seminar called Insight 2 and maybe a couple of those. So it was a rather full house at the time. So at that seminar in 1978, he talked about the work that he had been doing, but he much more so, at least that's how I recall, talked about the work that he was going to be involved in, and he talked about it in relation to MSI being in lots of places around the planet, Insight being involved with thousands and thousands of people doing that in various places around the world. He talked about what then was Kohinoor University. Some of you may have never heard of like Kohinoor University, which is now the University of Santa Monica. And that's a really magnificent program that John Roger also founded and has to do with spiritual psychology. And to, as far as we know, it's the only approved, accredited program in the United States that has a formal program that grants degrees in spiritual psychology. So it's, if you have any interest in that, it's also something that works for people who want to get a marriage, child and family license and that type of thing. And he was talking about the Heartfelt Foundation, which is our organization, does community service, not only in Los Angeles, but I think you occasionally do activities here in the New York area, certainly in the Northeast. I'm getting some nodding heads. So there's a lot of work that has come about that he was talking about. And I just knew this was something that I wanted to do. So that was the very first thing that was occurring to me when I was listening to him. And as I was sitting in the audience, I had an experience that my body became more charged up. I don't know if you can relate to this, but it was like I was plugged into some kind of electricity. And so my body was like vibrating. I didn't quite know what that was about, but I knew it was a little difficult to stay seated. And when I considered what was going on, what I was realizing was that I was excited. And there was somehow the energy of being excited and enthusiastic about what John Roger was talking about, and that he was talking directly to me, and that was part of it. I had this experience that his voice, and not only his voice, but it was like his voice, the sound of his voice, and the words he was saying was going directly into my body, like that was part of the current. And so I felt as though he was talking directly to me, like he knew I was there, and he was speaking to me about whatever issues I might have or my doubts, things that had happened to me. Any of you ever had an experience, something like that? When, okay, a few of you have had that experience. And that was in, I believe, July of 1978. And the following December, after quite a process seemed like somewhat like a lifetime, but what I refer to it now as my former life prior to that time. And then what I did was I chose to move to Los Angeles because I thought, well, if I move there, then I'll have a better opportunity to get involved in what John Roger's doing. And let me just tell you this about that decision. The decision, the knowing of the decision, the opportunity to make the decision, was there in July. And it was as clear at that moment as it was in November. So it took me somehow 5 months or so to make that decision, all the while thinking about it. And the thinking caused me not to do it. Has your thinking ever caused you not to do something? Okay. Now, to give the benefit to thinking, there are times when my thinking has spared me. You know, I, in a sense, thought better when an impulse or whatever it was, an urge or somebody saying, come on, let's do this. I found out later that I was glad that I didn't do that because my thinking kind of opened up, well, have you considered what would happen if you do that? And started considering some of those things. But that wasn't really what was in the way and causing me to hesitate. The hesitation was things like, well, I'm not sure if I can do that. And besides that, I'm not sure that if I come and I say, I'd like to be involved in what you're doing and participating in what you're doing, I wasn't really sure that somebody would say, okay, fine. And when I inquired, which I wrote a letter to the MSI office about, are there any opportunities to be involved? It was much more about, yeah, there's lots of opportunities to volunteer and to participate in ongoing events. There's much more activities and events that are available in Los Angeles than where I was, which was up in Sacramento, California. And I think at that time there were three of us who were on discourses. But we were a very active MSI community in our own way. And during this time, what I also recall was that while I was doing the discourses and starting to have some very impactful experiences, people that I knew that I wouldn't see for a month or a few months or maybe even several months kept telling me, "You're different. You know, what's going on?" It's almost like I was undergoing another puberty or something, because people were seeing all these changes. And one day I looked at myself in the mirror and I had this experience that I was a different person, that I could see it in what my face appeared to me to be. You know, the physical form, particularly in my face, was very different. And I knew that it was related to my involvement with the traveler. Now, what proof did I have? Did I have proof that the traveler was making cell changes and so somehow the bone structure and the way my flesh formed or appeared and the skin color or whatever was changing? I didn't have any direct knowledge about that. But what I did have was my own experience of it, that I was clearly changing and something was happening. I also started hearing some of the information that explained that to me, that's in the seminars and in the discourses. When we spiritualize ourselves, that there's a process so that the vibration of what we are physically begins changing. And, you know, that's one of the really great benefits of being involved, is to spiritualize yourself. It does take your participation. And I know we have some people that are in your first year of discourses here today. Anybody, you're in that category? You're on discourse 1 through 12 at this point? Okay. And so in some way, maybe you're hearing this for the first time, and I'm just telling you that change is in the order of what we do. I was also thinking about the Parthenon today. And you might say, well, why were you thinking about the Parthenon? Well, I was also thinking about the pyramids. And what I was considering, if you have never been to the pyramids, there. I just think about the most magnificent form that's on the planet, particularly the one that's referred to as the Great Pyramid. And part of what makes it so great is its mystery, that how it was created, how it was constructed, and what's been discovered in the process of studying the pyramid is quite amazing. I was told that there are more books written about the pyramids in Egypt than any other subject. Now, I don't know if that's true, but if it is even close to it, it underscores that there's something interesting. And perhaps the interest is, what is this and what happened? In the Bible, there's a part of the scriptures that talk about the chief cornerstone. And the chief cornerstone, if you don't know this, is the one that fits on top of the pyramid, because it's a cornerstone that's of all four sides. So it's referred to as the chief cornerstone. Of course, at the base, there are four other cornerstones, because in the base of a pyramid, whoever needs this is for you. So you may say, "John, I already know that. I already know there's four corners in a pyramid." I said, "Well, maybe somebody forgot and they thought there was three, or they just want to be reminded here. So let's give them a break and allow me to speak for them." And each cornerstone is very important, because it in some way holds the form, and it defines a very important part of how that form is created. The base of a pyramid is a perfect square. The sides of the pyramid are equilateral triangles, so each side is of the same length and distance. And then it comes to a point, an apex, and that last stone, the crowning stone, is referred to as the chief cornerstone. And that was a reference to the Messiah. That's in the Old Testament. So it's one of the names for that consciousness that is the Christ, is that it's the chief cornerstone, because it is at the apex. Now, if you know something about the pyramid, then you also know that of all the stones that went in to create the pyramid, there's only one that's currently missing. And it's the chief cornerstone. So it's the very top stone is not there. Now, some have postulated and theorized that it's because it was made of gold or something, that it was removed because of how precious it was, and what's underneath is very large, solid granite blocks. And some of them are 20, 40, 60 tons. And I want you to consider what's involved in lifting and placing something that weighs 20, 40, 60 tons. And then how would we do that today? And you go, well, you just get one of those big giant cranes and, with all those big steel gears or whatever it takes, and then they somehow strap it and lift it and they put it in place. And, well, where are the cranes? What happened to the cranes? And discovering the artifacts in the sands of Egypt, what happened to those cranes? See, and that's one of the great mysteries, is to this day, no one has satisfactorily explained in terms of today's technology and the idea that, well, you just got, if you get enough labor, labor was pretty cheap back then, and get some good ropes and pulleys, and you just, get a few hundred guys, pulling on the ropes, and up goes these, 60-ton solid granite blocks. And a few years back, a Japanese engineering or science kind of team came over, and they attempted in some way try every single theory that's ever been used to explain how it was constructed. So they were using the methods that would have been available several thousand years ago that were used to explain how it happened, and none of those methods were they able to recreate and do this. And not only that, the proportions, the lines, the precision in those blocks are such that with modern technology and the ability to cut a stone, there's a cutting of a stone, and to keep that precision and the proportion, they still can't recreate that either. So they don't know how they cut the stones so precise either, and then they don't know how they place them so that this wall is on perfect north and this wall is on perfect south. And how do they know those directions anyway? And how did they get it so that if you measure the circumference, well, it's not the circumference, but the perimeter of the base of the pyramid, that it then corresponds in terms of, I think it's inches, and that inches are related to cubits, and there's something sacred about the cubit because it relates directly to the measurements on the pyramid. So if you're sort of following this, that also relates to the circumference of the earth and the placements of the planets. And there's one relationship to the Stonehenge in England, that it's on a perfect line, like a 30-degree line or something like that. And you just, it just goes on and on and on. And somebody... I'm sure several people, but somebody realizes, like, well, look, at some point in trying to understand how this could have possibly been done, we're going to get beyond, there was this great genius, or there was this great school of geniuses that did that, because it's not answerable in human terms. It's not answerable by the ability of a mind. It's answerable by the ability of something miraculous, so that we still have, let's call it a monument in this place called Egypt. Not that there are places that where we don't have it, but in something that happened that was, as best we can tell, a man-made creation. So I think if you look at nature, you also see the miraculous. I mean, it's there in every suit. And in other words, it's not just in spades, it's in diamonds and hearts and clubs, jokers. Nature tells us a great story that in order to understand it, we have to get beyond what we can conceive. That's how we understand it. And I look at the pyramid and other things, but I'm just using this as a reference today, that there's something beyond what we know and what we can conceive that's really important for us to consider. And that's what we're doing in the movement of spiritual inner awareness. So that was the segue for all this discussion, was the pyramid relates directly to the movement of spiritual inner awareness. And you might say, can you tell me a little bit more about that? And if you're not so interested, just do your SEs for a while, and we'll probably get around to something that is of interest to you a little bit later. It's that we often do things and assume things because we can negotiate this level, like we can come into this room and somebody can hit a light switch and the electricity comes on, and we then decide, oh, I know about electricity. You see, you just go over to this light switch and you flip it and it comes on. So I know about electricity, I understand it. It's just that light switch. But do we really understand what that power is and how that works? And if we start considering things that we take for granted about our life, that something very good and wonderful starts happening, so that we start expanding and vibrating to bigger things. I was in a discussion, and these days we kind of need to qualify that, like what kind of discussion. Was it a face-to-face discussion? Was it a telephone discussion? Was it a discussion in correspondence, like you wrote a letter? And then there were a series of kind of back and forth discussion points. And at some point I just said, we have bigger fish to fry. And that was my way of saying, I'm making this decision and we're not discussing this any longer. And so that's the next part of my segue here, is we have bigger fish to fry. And there's bigger fish in spirit. So I hope that you're considering that how your life is being conducted and how you process your life. Let me just give you some examples that come to mind, how you pay your bills and who you live with and who you have a relationship with. So, and that can lead to things like children, and then what school do they go to, and where do you locate yourself, and where do you earn a paycheck of some kind, things like that. There's bigger fish to fry. So if in the course of your day that you're spending a great amount of your energy and your focus looking at, let's just call them material fish, that you deal with, the material things of this world, and you're not spending so much time looking at the bigger fish, the fish that are not material. And kind of what amazes me at times, and we also do a lot of discussion of this in MSIA, Let Me Count the Ways. The ways are through the discourses, the audio tapes, the videotapes. We have Peace Theological Seminary courses, wonderful, wonderful courses. We have a master program that's really about progressing into the more fine aspects of our teachings and our study materials. And now we have a doctoral program, one of which is going to be in your neighborhood, just a few blocks away. And in terms of the world, I mean, we're talking close. I mean, when you talk about, it's like 25,000 miles around before you come back to the same place. If you can manage to come back to the same place, because you might find you keep going around another 25,000 mile revolution and you don't pass the same place that you did last time. You can do that for a long time too. Sometimes referred to as reincarnation, or the reincarnation rag, but I'm not going there, and that's it. In any case, I'm personally calling you forward, I'm getting personal, to this doctoral program. Now, some of you may say, well, you called me forward and I really am interested, and they told me I'm not qualified, I don't have the necessary requirements in place in order to participate. Okay, fine, then your job is to get those necessary requirements in place. Because in the doctoral program, we deal with the biggest fish in God's creation. So there's where we're going. See, we're going to the biggest fish. This is all a fish discussion that started with the pyramid, but that's how it goes in MSA. We really take into consideration everything. And once we take into consideration everything, we get very particular. And we get particular because as long as we have energy units, and we do, and we have an opportunity as creators, and that's who we are, to deal with those energy units, then why not use them for the very best energy we can find? You're a beloved of God, you're cherished, and it protects you, it holds you. And the evidence is you're here now. And this is a place of protection. This is a place where all souls are embraced and held like a babe in the arms that is newly born and welcomed as the promised one, the one who God has spoken of through all time. And just know that this moment that you've been waiting for is here, Beirut Beis Shean.
John Morton's closing words were Beirut Beis Shean, which means the blessings already are. The blessings, the ideas, and the concepts which you've heard are just a small part of the abundance of material John Morton has shared with us over the years. If you would like a free book, Journey of a Soul, call this number, 1-800-899-2665. You can send email to servicedesk@msia.org or write to That Which Is, Post Office Box 513935, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90051-1935. This has been That Which Is with John Morton. Thanks for joining us.